Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This hour, let's revisit some of the more interesting conversations we've had so far this year. Like this one. It's a classic story of fiction. Powerful corporation wants to develop a large tract of pristine land. Local folks band together, persuade politicians, raise money, and save the land. Except this story is a real one, and it happened in Michigan. A new nonfiction book is out. The title is Saving Arcadia, a story of conservation and community in the Great Lakes. The author is Heather Shoemaker, and I spoke with her earlier this year. First of all, tell us where Arcadia Dunes is located.
Well, it's right along, as you'd expect, dunes right along Lake Michigan's coastline, and it's a little bit south of Frankfort.
Can you describe it and the nearby Greenpoint Dunes for us?
Oh, well, at first you have to sort of fall under this gaze of wonder because it brings awe. They're very, very tall sand dunes, and I like running down them with your hair kind of flying and just plunging down into Lake Michigan. But it's a pristine sugar sand beach at the bottom with Lake Michigan waves crashing around, and then a nice deserted sand dune that just towers above it. And then 6,000 acres of natural land and some farmland stretching around there. Greenpoint Dunes is sort of a bookend to Arcadia Dunes. They're two dunes that look at each other, and you can walk between them along the beach.
Now, people love nature for lots of reasons. Some love bird watching. Some love hunting. You clearly love the unique and rare plants that grow in a place such as the Arcadia. Why are they important?
Well, so many of us love going out at different times of year to see what nature has to offer. But one thing that's very amazing about the sand dunes is that they have plant species and some animal species that don't appear anywhere else on our planet. So they're called an endemic. They're a Great Lake species that lives just in this very narrow habitat, which not a lot of things can live on because the sand dunes, the sand is constantly blowing, and it's a harsh environment to live in. So the animals and plants that do make it their home have to have pretty good survival strategies.
Really adaptable, yeah. This land used to be owned by a lot of farm families back in the 1960s, but something came in and bought 6,000 acres. Who bought it and why?
Well, at first it was a big mystery. You know, somebody was going around, one man was going around knocking on all the farmers' doors, and everybody was speculating, who is this guy? They figured they had some big money behind him, but, you know, who was it and what was the big power behind him? It turned out to be the utility, Consumers Power, as it was called then. Now it's part of CMS Energy. And they were buying it originally to build a pump storage facility like the one they did build in Ludington. So what that is, it's flooding the land, and it had to be pretty high land, which is why they were attracted to the dune. So pouring that into a reservoir they were going to make, and then at times of peak energy demand, they would have released that water down into Lake Michigan and generating extra electricity. So the plan was to buy up this 6,000 acres, flood it, and use it for energy production.
And that's a big story in itself, but let's move on because I want to get to the fun stuff. But these CMS plans for the Lake Energy Scheme never came about. Then there was talk of resorts, big private residences, full-on development of the Arcadia Dunes. What happened to those plans?
Well, they were very close to being realized. But so many people during the time since this book spans a 40-year history. And during that 40 years when the land was not flooded and developed in various ways, it sat there rather empty. And people started to fall in love with it. So all the local folks would start hiking there or the camping, doing all sorts of things and getting to know it. So when the idea that it was really going to be developed, when this new plans came to have that be a serious threat, people were ready to rally for the land. And at the time, I worked for a land trust, the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy up in Traverse City. And my job was to help preserve beautiful natural areas and turn them into protected land where people could hike and enjoy it and the species could continue to live their lives. So we decided to take on the daunting project of preserving this 6,000-acre tract of land.
I want to talk about some of these people. The way you describe the characters, the real people in your book, is through their idiosyncrasies rather than, you know, a summation of them. And I really like that. But all of those community members, they have that connection, as you mentioned, to the Arcadia Dunes. What did they first think about when Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy said they might buy the land?
Well, of course, there was a lot of secrecy at first because we were doing negotiations with the corporation, and we had to do that very quietly and, you know, in meeting rooms downstate and so on. So for a long time, we were busy working on it and nobody knew. But they always there were a lot of hopes. There were a lot of hopes harbored on that land. The farm families, some of them the same ones who'd had to sell their land to consumers years and years ago, were still hoping to buy back their family home, family farms, and move back to the land. And it's a great orchard site for cherries and grapes and apples and so on. So they were all hoping to be able to buy it back again. And others were hoping that it wouldn't be developed so they can continue to visit it. But when we finally did spill the beans, there was a variety of reactions, some of horror that, oh, no, it's going to be developed, and people were really scared. They were scared sort of to the depths of their soul, and I think that's one reason why so many people rallied around to help preserve it. It was such a community effort where we had people from bakers to innkeepers to farmers to bank presidents. You know, everybody was pulling together, and what was wonderful is that with all those people pulling for it, you could have nearly an introduction to anybody you needed if you were trying to find money to raise or somebody to bend the governor's ear. There was somebody who could introduce you.
Raising the money to purchase the Arcadia Dunes was really complex. There were a lot of groups. There was government money, philanthropic money, private donations, a lot of moving parts. The Land Conservancy was really punching above its weight. I'm looking back, how did you folks actually manage to pull this off?
Yes, well, I think if we'd known just how impossible it was, we probably wouldn't have dared to start the project. It started by I was dreaming, looking at a bunch of maps and saying, wow, look at that big property. And of course, big is always good for land conservation. So I was just dreaming and thinking, well, let's try it. And my ally was Glenn Chown, who is the director of the Land Conservancy. And he just, you know, we caught fire together and said, let's try it. Of course, if we'd known what was involved, it probably wouldn't have started it. But it was so full of hope. It was such a campaign of audacious hope. And I think people realized that we were serious and we were passionate, but that we needed a lot of help. And they all came and rallied around, and we pulled it off by a miracle.
You note that the story of Arcadia Dunes really doesn't end, that obtaining Arcadia Dunes and Greenpoint Dunes was just a commencement. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the business of land protection, you can say that the day that the title transfers into your name is the day that you've preserved the land. But really, land continues on through time and space, and you do have to continue to take care of it. So just because the Conservancy owns a lot of that land now doesn't mean that it's safe. For example, nature preserves have to be loved over time and cared for. There can be timber trespass. There can be invasive species that come in and change the landscape. There can be illegal dumping. There can be climate change. There's so many things that can impact a landscape. And you need to continually groom the next set of people, the next set of stewards of the land, because human beings are only really here on this earth for a pretty short time, and we want the landscape to endure.
Are Arcadia Dunes and Greenpoint Dunes now open to the public, wide open? Can they go in, walk, hike, ski?
Yes. Greenpoint Dunes is just a couple miles north of Arcadia Dunes, and you can go and hike and be on that property. It's open to the public. And Arcadia Dunes is technically a larger landscape, so several thousand acres are open to the public for hiking and skiing and mountain biking and bird watching and everything, and hunting during certain seasons. But also some of the Arcadia Dunes land has been purposely transferred to private hands, and the land has been able to be returned to many of the same farm families that originally owned the land, and that's private land, so you're not allowed on that part. But it's subject to conservation restrictions, so there wouldn't be houses and buildings going up on that farmland.
But our orchards, I take it.
Yes, it's primarily orchards, some Christmas trees, some vineyards. Mm-hmm.
And that works well adjacent to the larger preserve?
you know, when you're preserving a smaller nature preserve, you can draw a line and say, here's nature, and we're going to make the boundary, and this is where you take your walk, and it's wild. And then, you know, you have the rest of the world. But when you're trying to preserve something large like this is, when you're trying to preserve an entire landscape, you have to integrate people and economic livelihoods into the whole picture. And that's what made this project exciting, is that it's not a it's big enough that it's not just one part that's has a line around it and says this is a nature preserve. Part of it's a nature preserve, but part of it's a living landscape with farms on it.
Well, I'm wondering what the local people think of what you've done.
Well, there's always a wide variety of opinion anytime you get a group of people together, and that's no different than farmers or any other group of people. But most people, the process we went through, I think, is very open and inclusive and respectful. And I was the one leading a lot of the interactions with the local neighbors. And what we found is that I invited their opinions and invited their expertise into the process. And so by drawing on a local knowledge, we were able to make it a lot stronger and a better conservation plan than we ever would without them. So my hope is that they are quite pleased living living as part of the Arcadia Dunes landscape.
Heather Shoemaker is the author of the new book, Saving Arcadia, A Story of Conservation and Community in the Great Lakes. I got to tell you, I thought it was a really good read, and I'm glad you wrote it for us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Coming up, the city of Detroit is cracking down on blight, even the small things.
If a window is broke, then someone will think no one cares about their property. They'll start dumping on that property or squatting in that property or, you know, maybe trying to do other illegal activities in that property.
With the number of abandoned houses in Detroit, it's a huge job. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Some neighborhoods have been devastated by abandoned homes and the scrappers who strip them. The Morningside neighborhood on Detroit's east side hasn't hit the level of devastation, but it's been hit pretty hard. Reverend Darrell Reed is the president of the Morningside Community Organization. He's also a resident and a landlord. He remembers back in 2006 when things started to go wrong.
I was driving through the community, and I just seen dumpsters everywhere in front of houses. It's like, what is going on? And that's, I believe that's when the first wave of people were put out of their houses for foreclosure. And it consistently happened every month.
First, it was the mortgage foreclosures by banks who'd been involved in predatory lending in the 1990s. Reed says once the houses were empty, there was a rush to steal furnaces, electrical boxes, architectural details of any value.
Someone with aluminum siding on their house, the entire house would be stripped. And you'll see a guy walking down the street with a buggy full of aluminum siding.
It was just the beginning. After mortgage foreclosures, property values plummeted further. Real estate assessments did not. For years, people were taxed as if their homes were worth far more than their actual value. After crime, tax foreclosures are now Detroit's biggest problem. Since Detroit's bankruptcy, priorities for the police department have changed. Yeah, violent crime's still a top priority, but it's believed minor crimes can quickly lead to a neighborhood's decline.
If a window is broke, then someone will think no one cares about their property, and they'll start dumping on that property or, you know, squatting in that property or, you know, maybe trying to do other illegal activities in that property.
That's neighborhood police officer DeAndre Gaines. Unlike a regular patrol officer, neighborhood police officers are assigned to a certain area. It's Detroit's version of community policing. Gaines says he's looking for blight violations. He'll ticket property owners who don't properly board up vacant houses. He'll cite people for high grass, trash containers out when it's not pickup day, setting bulk items for trash pickup too early.
Different things like that. That's why mainly our top things that we look for to make the community look better, make it look more livable and make it, you know, the property value increase instead of decrease.
Abandoned houses decrease property values on a block. In the Morningside neighborhood, the Detroit Land Bank Authority reports it's had to tear down 260 structures in the last 3 years. 17 more are either contracted or in the pipeline for demolition, and neighbors are hoping that happens soon. Gaines says the land bank has been a good partner. When he finds its properties have not been mowed or need to be boarded up, the land bank is quick to get someone out to take care of it. But some neighbors complain the land bank is not enforcing its own rules. When it sells a house, it's supposed to be fixed up and someone living there within 6 months. Some houses bought from the land bank have been sitting empty for 2 years in Morningside. A spokesman for the land bank says they want to give the new owners every chance of success. If that means waiting a little longer, it's better than seizing the house and starting all over again. Officer Gaines says those things the neighbors in Morningside can control, such as lawns and trash cans, are important to enforce. But there are some things beyond the control of neighbors.
And probably the biggest issue in Morningside is this illegal dumping.
Any vacant lot or abandoned house is a target for dumpers. But there are some favorite places, such as Barham Street.
It's the perfect dumping ground. You know, you don't have many houses.
Yeah, there's a couple of couches and a bunch of other trash as we're driving by. I've driven this street many, many times now, and there's always something new that's been dumped.
There's always something new. You got City of Detroit DPW out here.
We stopped to chat. That day, two different crews of Detroit's Department of Public Works were cleaning construction debris, piles of tree limbs, furniture, and just household trash dumped along the street. It's hard to say who's dumping. Neighbors who found envelopes with addresses in the trash have done what they can to track down those dumpers. But big trucks sometimes dump construction debris in the middle of the night, and few are caught.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Okay, this has got to be one of the scariest things a person can hear. You have cancer. And maybe you've heard that in your life or in the life of a close friend or relative. If you've not, you can imagine the anxiety and the other likely psychological issues to accompany that cancer diagnosis and all that goes with it. There is a subspecialty of oncology called psycho-oncology, and here to talk about how that works are Michelle Reba, Associate Director of the University of Michigan Depression Center, and Bill Howe, who is a cancer survivor and found psycho-oncology treatment helpful. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Dr. Reba, I read that this idea originated as far back as the mid-1970s, but it wasn't fully embraced for a while. If a cancer patient was struggling back then, what did healthcare professionals do before psycho-oncology?
Well, it was very difficult. A lot of doctors, physicians, oncologists didn't necessarily ask about psychiatric issues, and patients and families didn't understand that they could ask and then get treatment for it. And so the subspecialty grew to what it is today.
So tell me how it works today then.
Well, I can tell you what it works at our cancer center, the University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center, where we have an embedded psychiatric clinic right at the cancer center, and all patients who receive their care at our cancer center are entitled to be evaluated and treated. And it's just a wonderful opportunity and ease of access for our patients and practitioners.
Is there automatic screening for everyone who gets a diagnosis of cancer?
Yes. The American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network have developed guidelines for patients in the United States, and at our cancer center, we regularly screen for distress. And then based on that information and those guidelines, then patients are triaged further.
Mr. Howe, I'd like you to tell me, if you would, when did you learn you had cancer? Can you tell me about that time?
Certainly. I got the diagnosis of when I had a PA sample taken by my general practitioner.
Which, if you're a guy, you know that's your prostate measurement.
Yes, yeah, and it's a very good test. And I was about 55 years of age, and the PSA was very high. And subsequently, I had surgery, and the unfortunate part of it was the surgery didn't get all the cancer. It was outside the prostate. And so that became the major issue for me.
Now, that becomes the scarier part, because a lot of guys are walking around with prostate cancer, but not outside, not once it's left. So was that the point it really hit you? Or?
Yes, I think it becomes overwhelming, because I think you start to think about, first of all, this is it. Am I going to continue my life or am I not? And then you start asking yourself the questions about, what about my family? You know,
That's something I want to get to a little further. I want to talk about that because, I can't imagine you're thinking about what's going to become of my kids, my wife. Are they going to be okay and all those things? But I want to get back to how this felt to you. I mean, what was your gut feeling when you found this out?
My initial feeling was extreme anxiety. Being diagnosed with cancer, you start asking yourself a lot of questions, and there are a lot of questions but very few answers.
Did the depression start slipping in suddenly, or did it just build up over time? Tell me about how you experienced that.
Well, I believe that initially you had, or I had, extreme anxiety, and then you morph into a major depression disorder in my case. And it was during the treatment where I received, after surgery, I received chemotherapy, radiation, and hormone therapy. And it was during that time that it just became so apparent that I was in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. So for somebody who's never had depression, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as a situation where the first thing you ask yourself is, why me? The second thing you say to yourself, what is this going to mean? But from a realistic or kind of a simply stated point of view, it's you're in a black hole. Nothing's pleasurable. You want to sleep all the time. You have a feeling that you're never going to get out and that there is no successful treatment or anything you can do to help yourself.
Tell me how soon, where did you get help?
Well, it was fortunate enough. I had my surgery not at the cancer center, but my follow-up care was at the University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I was fortunate enough to have Dr. Pienta, who is a national expert on prostate cancer, treat me. And when we went through the various stages, and today it's in remission, and that's where I hope it stays.
How did you get the treatment for depression? Where did you find help?
Well, it was during this time that it became very apparent that it was getting worse, and I wasn't able to handle it. And that's so unusual for me. I've had a successful career. I've done many things in my life, and to have this happen to me and all of a sudden become so weak that I can't find a way out was very, very scary, frankly. And so I got referred to Dr. Reba and started care with her during my treatments, and really was a difference.
What did she do that helped you the most?
I think there's a two-pronged approach. One is the medications that for depression, which are very good today. And secondly, the psychotherapy, being able to combine the medication with the counseling that you receive. And I often say it's finding a path out. And she was so good at finding a path out for me.
Dr. Reba, when somebody gets cancer and the patient, as we mentioned, is not the only one affected, the spouse, the children, people near and dear to that person are also affected. Are they screened or offered help in a situation like this?
Well, we always say that cancer is a family illness. So I always ask the patient to try to bring a significant other in to see, first of all, if they could offer us help in the loved one who has cancer, but also in themselves, because it's a real burden often on the caretaker. And then we also ask about children or other significant members of the family, how they're doing. We want to make sure that children, too much burden isn't being put on them. We want to make sure that the family can stay intact and help one another.
How common is it that cancer patients end up with depression, for example, or some other mental health issue that they need care?
Well, it depends on the stage of cancer, the type of cancer, how old the person is, and other co-occurring medical conditions. But in general, one can think about 50% of patients during the course of their cancer care will have a diagnosable psychiatric condition. Now, that can be anxiety, depression, substance abuse, personality issues, delirium. But you can think about 50% of patients will have it. Now, what we're most interested in is the functionality and the quality of life of patients. So we want to help patients who have had a history of a psychiatric problem, treat that. We want to make sure we can prevent certain conditions and help people through their care. Many of these psychiatric issues and conditions are very, very treatable, as they were in Bill's case.
How often does a cancer treatment hospital or unit actually have psycho-oncology? Is that a fairly common thing these days, or is that still fairly rare?
Well, we're very fortunate at our cancer center. We've had this program between the Department of Psychiatry and the Cancer Center and the Depression Center for close to 20 years. So I think we were a model. You know, we're one of the top programs, I think, in the country for this. And we have a multidisciplinary staff of psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, chaplains, art and music therapists. So it's very interdisciplinary. And we try to help patients at various stages with these various forms of care.
I guess I'm trying to find out how many clinics across the nation actually offer these kinds of services like U of M does.
I think most of the major cancer centers throughout the country have some form of a psycho-oncology program. And psychiatrists and oncologists in the community are very much aware of this, because we know that there are interactions between chemotherapy agents and treatments that psychiatrists have to be aware of, and vice versa.
Mr. Howell, you were still trying to work while dealing with cancer and anxiety. How did that work out?
Not very well. You find yourself focusing on cancer probably 90% of the time and work 10% of the time. When you first get diagnosed and you start to get this overwhelming feeling of what's going to happen to my wife. I mean, first of all, have we saved enough so she can be taken care of? What about my two sons or my grandchildren? Am I all done with them, seeing their life grow as it has in the past? And I think that when you come to understanding that there are no easy answers, that's the most scary part of it. But it becomes so overwhelming that all you're doing is researching in your mind answers to questions that have very few answers.
Dr. Reed, before a lot of people work or activities are their self-identity. I mean, what do you do when you can't function at work anymore because you're so distracted by the disease that might kill you?
I think those are some of the very difficult situations and problems that we have to negotiate with people. Years ago, you asked earlier about in the 1970s. Years ago, we used to help people stop working very early, and we've learned that helping people continue to work, if that's what they choose to do, and depending on the type of job they have and work they have, is sometimes very therapeutic. So how to think about that and negotiate that, and some jobs are easier than others to work part-time or to have a reduced work schedule. But for many of us, work is our identity. That's who we think of when we, you know, what do you do is often a very important question. And so when that changes because of an illness or a rigorous treatment schedule is sometimes very difficult for people. In addition, the finances of having cancer are very problematic. Sometimes people have to go on disability and you know, at an early age, and they have mortgages and tuitions. And so what does that mean? Maybe the other significant other has to go back to work. And then what about the children and savings? And so
yeah, it spirals out of control after
yes,
a while.
Yes, yes. So those are important issues. And how do we help people through the survivorship is also an important aspect of this.
Bill, I want to ask you if you, you know, I don't, maybe you've met someone close to you that's been diagnosed with cancer. I mean, what do you tell them? Or if you had the opportunity to tell somebody, what would you tell them?
Well, in my situation, I was quite close. I had two brothers die of cancer, one of large cell lymphoma and one from bladder cancer. And since that time and since my treatment, I try to talk to as many people as I can about the value of the medication, about the value of the therapy and the counseling together, because one is left hand, one is right hand, and together you need them both. And I think that trying to convey this to people I run into from time to time, which has happened quite often, more often than I'd like to see, but and it's worked out very successfully.
That's Bill Halm. He is one of the patients of Dr. Reba and a cancer survivor. Michelle Reba is associate director at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Thanks for coming in and telling us about psycho-oncology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Your town is getting by on less money because for years now, the state legislature has been taking a bigger share of the state sales tax. That's meant cuts in fixing streets and sidewalks, cut in police and fire departments, cuts in other city services. Why did the state government start taking a larger share? Well, it had to fix its own budget problems, and they did that with municipal money. That forced municipalities into their own budget problems in some cases. Joining me to talk about that are city officials from two cities of different parts of the state. Marcus Pecha is city manager of Cadillac, a city of 10,000, about 50 miles south of Traverse City. And Karen Majewski, the mayor of Hamtramck, a city of about 20,000 in Metro Detroit. The Michigan Municipal League says from 2001 to 2014, municipalities lost out on more than $6 billion because of reductions in revenue sharing. Marcus, how much has Cadillac lost during that period?
We have lost over $4.5 million during that period of time.
What's your annual budget?
Our annual budget in its entirety, including all funds, is about $19.5 million. Our general fund budget, or that money coming just from the taxpayers, is right around $6.5 million. So as you can see, that loss for Cadillac is really significant.
Mayor Majewski, how much money did Hamtramck lose from 2001 to 2014?
From 2003 to 2014, we lost about $13.3 million. And, you know, that's almost the equivalent of a full year's general fund budget for us.
For both of you, what kind of cuts have you made in city services? Mr. Pecha, we'll start with you.
Most notably, the city has cut staff. It's been a protracted process over the years. We're down about 20% from our high. We've essentially reduced our numbers of bodies to maintain, simply put, just our core set of public programs. And we're doing it with a skeleton crew. We've restructured our benefit program as well. So it's not just the removal of staff and keeping things the same, but it's been taking a whole new look at how we provide compensation as well to our staff, which has also been kept very much in check. We've had a very conservative approach to our benefit and compensation packages.
I think the legislature would say, well, good, they're being efficient. Have your citizens noticed a difference in city services?
I think so. To a certain degree, it almost depends on the season and the Mother Nature activities. You know, we're down to essentially one operational crew from our Public Works Department year-round. And so, especially in the winter, with winter conditions, it makes it more difficult for us to provide the same level of services that we want to provide and what our citizens expect. It takes, depending upon the conditions, anywhere from 2 to 5 days to completely clean up the town and remove the snow piles and relocate them, which is something that we used to be able to do in a faster fashion. So we're still getting the job done, but we're just having to do it differently. And also, certainly, our capital improvements projects, they have not stopped, but they certainly have slowed down. We're not able to do as many road improvements or other infrastructure-related improvements that we once used to be able to do. That's something that while people may not visually see, certainly we recognize that it's a problem. In the city of Cadillac, it could take anywhere from 70 to 85 years before a street is redone once it's done. That's certainly far beyond the life expectancy of a road. Exactly.
Mayor Majewski, same question. What kind of cuts have you had to make?
You know, I think that all cities in Michigan have been facing the same problem and addressing it in many of the same ways. You know, you look at what city services can be scaled back. You look at what you can do with personnel, how many jobs you can cut, how many positions you can combine. These are the things that we've been doing, what other sources of income there might be, and that's often grants, which, of course, are under the gun as well. So what adjustments you can make to union contracts and particularly OPEB benefits to our retirees.
Right.
That's always a target and an unpopular target and a regrettable target. You know, just as the state reneges on the promises that they've made to us in terms of funding, that means that we have to turn on our own former employees and pass a burden on to them that is also in many ways not fair. You know, I think that all cities are facing the problems and facing them in some of the same ways, looking to combine services with other municipalities. But many of those things were already done even before the downturn in the economy, the Great Recession, which affected all of us across the board, and the attempts by the state to also withhold funding from us. I mean, those are all things that any responsible city is looking to do anyway, looking for the ways to provide essential services and even more than essential services, the services that make a community a good place to live and provide a good quality of life. You're always looking for ways, no matter what the economy is and no matter where your money is coming from, you're always looking for ways to provide those services in a better way and to provide more services. And like all cities, we've had to, in some ways, cut back on our services and our promises to our residents. I have to say, happily, though, we've also, in that process, found some ways to provide services at a better cost.
I want to talk about the laundry list of cuts that you've experienced, because the personal property tax disappeared. That was the industrial tax. You also have seen property values go down, and the fact that the way our system works, the taxes on those properties won't catch up as fast as the home values do. And most cities, as you mentioned, have underfunded pension plans, higher health care costs for retired workers. It's kind of like a triple gut punch to the budgets. Are your state representatives and state senators aware of these issues?
Lester, I think that they are aware. And to a certain degree, I think that they're holding on to this concept of hope that through the personal property tax reform, you know, that Michigan is going to spark, right? That's the catalyst that's going to spark this significant new investment and redevelopment by industry in our communities that will then create this trickle-down effect to the local level, frankly, where you'll see this influx of new investment that'll lead to an influx of new jobs that'll then lead to an influx of new people moving in or reinvesting in their properties, redeveloping, new developers coming in and whatnot that will ultimately lead to a plus to a community's bottom line.
Have you seen any evidence of that?
Well, and that's where I was about to throw some statistics out. In our neck of the woods, no, not yet at a level in which I can comfortably say that it's actually leading to an uptick in that bottom line. You know, we read headlines almost daily about one big automaker or another investing $1 billion here or $1 billion there. That has not yet necessarily created this sort of statewide influx of dollars. In 2016, as a for instance, 22% of the city's total taxable value, which equated to about 10% of our total general fund revenues, came from personal property tax dollars. In 2017, after now there's been, you know, an implementation in part of the new tax reform, that's now down to 13% of our total taxable value and 6% of our general fund revenues. And so you see it's heading in a sort of downward spiral, which is really scary for a city, especially a small city, where we don't necessarily have a lot of new opportunity for a major plant or a major operator to come in. We certainly have an incredibly robust industrial park with multiple tier suppliers to the auto industry and other industries, which is fantastic for a community of our size. But, you know, I don't have the 200 acres of developable land necessarily where that I can accommodate some major new investors. So while perhaps it's working in some parts of the state, I haven't quite seen it yet work with communities such as Cadillac.
Mayor Mariaski, I'll give you the same question. I want to find out if you're having conversations with your legislators about these problems.
I mean, I think that our local legislators in Southeast Michigan are aware of the situation. I'm not sure that outstate the representatives are as clued into the devastating effects of their financial decisions on the communities. And part of that comes from our term limits, the way term limits have taken away institutional knowledge and how every couple of years we've got to re-educate our legislators.
Well, one would guess that some of these folks have municipal backgrounds, right?
You would think, and you would think that that would carry over. But I think that in many cases, and I would say overall, that this has not played out that way, you know, once folks get to the legislature. Piggybacking off of what the city manager said is that, you know, this expected trickle-down effect that I don't see any evidence for. And over 30 years or so, you know, I've never seen any evidence for. It intersects with the plan that the state also articulates of, you know, building strong communities. And the MML talks about
sense of place.
As part of its
right.
sense yeah. of place, a place that folks want to be a part of, that they have a good quality of life and that they want to invest in financially and, you know, in terms of their families and their lives. If you don't have investment in things like your infrastructure, if you don't have investment in city services that aren't declining but are growing, you are not going to be able to compete with other places that may be more, you know, financially stable in state or out of state. And so there's a snowball effect actually of disinvestment and loss because the cities can no longer provide the kinds of services and levels of services that residents expect and that they should expect. And so the investment goes elsewhere, then you have a snowball effect of disinvestment.
Mr. Pitch, I want to ask you, are the citizens of Cadillac aware of the financial struggles the cities had to deal with?
We're doing everything we can to make them aware. We have a tremendous amount of information and data that we share through social media, through our website, as a part of our public meetings, and it's part of our dialogue with the community when we have the chance to talk about a lot of the positive things that we're doing, but to sort of couch it as, you know, we're doing these things because of some of these other things. And so while we talk about the decline of revenue sharing and the softness of property values, you know, we also talk about what we are trying to do to improve ourselves. And as the mayor just mentioned, you know, the sense of place and placemaking, you know, Cadillac has essentially tried to grab the reins of a runaway horse from the state and sort of take control of its own destiny. And we have fully, in part, have fully embraced the whole placemaking concept through the leadership from the Michigan Municipal League, Michigan State University, Michigan State Extension, and MISHTA took a major role in the placemaking program that they had, and since then have created a new place for the community to gather at called Cadillac Commons, which is something that is really transformational for our community in our core downtown area. But since moving forward with the placemaking projects that comprise the Cadillac Commons area, we have seen a resurgence of new investment in our downtown area, which is something that I'm not so certain may have come if the community didn't also see the city itself reinvesting in itself.
Mr. Pecha, I got to tell you, if you decide that you're tired of being a city manager, you should definitely work with the Chamber of Commerce there because you're pro-Cadillac. Mayor Majewski, I want to ask you, at one point, Hamtramck was taken over by an emergency manager, and I've been wondering if these cities that have been taken over by an EM would have faced those financial troubles if their revenue sharing had remained at the level it was before.
Revenue sharing is not the only financial problem that cities face. The loss of property values was devastating for many cities, you know, restructuring of personal property tax and other issues. Certainly, revenue sharing alone was not the deciding factor, I would say. But combined with all these other losses, it just becomes a devastating effect. A lot of cities who have not gone into emergency management teeter on the brink. One of the things that sets off emergency management status is that a city has to ask to be examined and to be evaluated by the state. Above my objections, by the way, because I'd been through it before. The city of Hamtramck's been through emergency management and before that through emergency financial management, both while I was in office. You know, I know what that process is like and how devastating it can be for a city. But you know, Hamtramck may be a poster child for that process, but there are many, many cities, because of the preponderance of all of these factors, that are teetering on that brink. And, you know, if community development block grants also go away, our federal government is talking about
reducing those or eliminating
them completely. I mean, many of our cities depend on those funds, CDBG funds, for things like code enforcement, for the things, again, that make life livable, for park improvement, for the things that the city's budget otherwise couldn't accommodate.
I have one more question for both of you. Given the financial struggles of cities around the state, when you hear that the governor wants to have a $500 million rainy day fund, when you hear that the legislature is considering an income tax rollback, and you're still not getting the money, you're not made whole. What do you think of those moves in Lansing? Mr. Petcha, we'll start with you.
I think that they really need to be examined in great detail. I don't have a problem with our state government having a rainy day fund. If not for the very conservative budgeting and financial processes that Cadillac has been doing long before I ever arrived and since I've arrived, we would perhaps be in major trouble ourselves. But we're not, and that's because of our very strong conservative fiscal planning. But, you know, to have a rainy day fund at that magnitude that's being proposed and being talked about in combination with also reducing the income tax levy, I think that that could potentially be a combination or a mixture for ultimate financial disaster and ruin for many more communities across this state. I think that the state needs to figure out a manner in which to carve away a portion of what that potential fund is going to be and, rightly so, return it back under state shared revenue formulas to the communities. Ultimately, the services that people across this state get come from the local communities. Businesses are going to locate in communities in which they feel that there's strong support for infrastructure, for recreational opportunities, for you know, the ability for their employees to have a high quality of life. It starts at that grassroots local level. And, you know, if the local level of governance is being strangled, it makes it very difficult, I think, for Michigan to compete, not just in the Midwest, but frankly, on a national scale, if not greater. So I think it's an incredibly important thing for our state to really fully examine and have that conversation with folks at the local level so that they understand the impacts and what their decision making will potentially do.
Mayor Majewski, you get the last word.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with that. Of course, you know, we all need to have some money in the bank, but we also need to invest our resources and invest for development and for further growth, and to have you know, too large a surplus sitting so that politicians can say, well, look at how much money we have, how much money we've saved.
I think the governor would describe it differently.
I think many of these decisions are political decisions, and, you know, decisions based on the next election. And it really does a disservice to the larger impacts that those decisions have on communities that build the state and that frankly create the environment that would attract investment, as the city manager has said, and that would build the state and develop the state in such a way that we really can compete nationally.
Karen Majewski is the mayor of Hamtramck. Marcus Petcha is the city manager of Cadillac. I want to thank you both for coming in and talking to us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we can't possibly know about at all. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. So if you have a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Josh Hakala. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.